You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Dr. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at London's Birkbeck University. Oscar, what three stories have you got for us?
Big Brother is watching, the United States is reading your emails, and the Venezuelan drama continues.
Plus, after a week where the ability of the US, as we've been hearing, to collect information is revealed to have reached new levels, we look at global cyber warfare and find out where the battle lines are drawn.
And Monocle's urbanist team head to the New Cities Summit in Sao Paulo to sit down with Lady Barbara Judge.
Thinking about the problems, intellectualizing is a good thing to have around you, but that's not the person that's going to drive forward the change. You need real leaders to drive forward the change they're dealing with here and now, not 40 years from now.
We'll also be joined by renowned author Wendy Law Yone to talk through her new book, a reflection on her memoirs as the daughter of founder of Burma's The Nation newspaper.
All that, plus we play some music too, all to come here on the next hour at Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Turkey's ruling AK party has ordered protesters to leave Istanbul's central Gezi Park immediately. Plans to redevelop the park led to the protests, which lasted almost 2 weeks and spread to other Turkish cities. Early on Thursday, riot police fired smoke grenades to disperse protesters in the capital, Ankara. AK's deputy chairman said it would consider holding a referendum on the redevelopment plans for residents of Istanbul. Turkey's president has called for dialogue with legitimate demonstrators after riot police cleared the Istanbul square at the centre of the protests on Tuesday night, but a handful of demonstrators is still in Taksim Square.
It's 17th day and we are waiting the same thing, police attacks, and we want to protect this area and we just want to tell something to government and to all over the country. And about freedom, about the park, about the green, about the trees, and everything is the same.
Supporters of the Greek national TV station ERT have held a protest concert at its Athens headquarters the day after the government closed it down without warning. The government said it would soon be opening a new station that would be cheaper and more efficient, but ERT's closure has prompted a 24-hour general strike. Prime Minister Antonis Samaras said it was in the public interest to reform and relaunch the country's state broadcaster as it was full of waste and lacked transparency. Journalists are continuing to broadcast on a small analogue signal in Athens and live streaming on websites. One of them, Manolis Kypraiou, was not impressed by the Prime Minister's words.
The Prime Minister said a few minutes ago, we have a total war with the press. This is a hard line political thinking.
Roughly one in three Americans say the former security contractor Edward Snowden, who leaked details of top secret US surveillance activity, is a patriot and shouldn't be prosecuted. That's according to a new Reuters Ipsos poll. Some 23% of those surveyed said Snowden is a traitor, while 31% said he's a patriot, and another 46% said they didn't know. Snowden revealed last week that the NSA is monitoring a wide swathe of telephone and internet activity as part of its counter-terrorism efforts. He's now in Hong Kong and says he'll fight any attempt to extradite him to the US. The director of the Hong Kong Human Rights Monitor, Law Yuk Kai, isn't certain that he'll succeed.
Sadly, you feel that Hong Kong's judicial system is great. I must say that it's great as far as China can keep its hand off. Then China has its hands sometimes in it. So we cannot say that it would be definitely a fair game for Mr. Snowden. But international pressure and media attention would probably help him a bit.
6 months on from the massacre at Sandy Hook School in Newton, Connecticut, family members of some of the victims have returned to Washington as the Obama administration plans to restart its push for gun control measures. Nicole Hockley lost her six-year-old son Dylan in the shooting, and she insists that momentum for new gun control laws hasn't faded.
It's important that the lawmakers remember that we are still here and that we're not going away, and this is an issue that we're not going to allow to fade into the background. It's too important. It's too common sense.
The Australian long-distance swimmer Chloe McArdle has abandoned her attempt to become the first person to swim the 103 miles from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage after being stung by a jellyfish on Wednesday night. In a statement, her support team said she'd been forced to give up the attempt after 11 hours in the water due to a severe debilitating jellyfish sting. She's been taken to Key West and will spend the next 24 hours considering whether to try again. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London. New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. The time is 15.06 in Hong Kong, 10.06 in Istanbul. Well, that makes it 8.06am here in London.
And we start the show with our agenda setter, stories you need to know for the next 24 hours. And the agenda is set today by Dr. Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at London's Birkbeck University. Good morning, Oscar. Tell us what we want to start with today. What is really at the top of your agenda?
The big story today is undoubtedly Edward Snowden's comments. For the first time since disclosing, he was the source of a series of leaks from the US National Security Agency. Big Brother is indeed watching.
So it's significant that he is really sort of setting out his case, becoming something of a real point of, international controversy. He's speaking to the South China Morning Post. He's speaking from hiding in that part of the world, at least. It really sets up the sort of battle lines in this scenario.
This is becoming a huge story. I mean, it has been going on for a while, actually. At some point, even Julian Assange intervened. He suggested that Snowden should seek some sort of asylum in Latin America. For now, Snowden is going to remain in China. But the big revelations he made to the China Daily are quite interesting. He pointed out that he was releasing the information to demonstrate, and I quote him, the hypocrisy of the US government when it claims that it does not target civilian infrastructure unlike its adversaries.
Indeed, and I suppose it really sets up a new sort of type of conflict within these revelations. It was embarrassing for various different parties before. Now, I suppose it's potentially concerning. We're going to be talking about cyber warfare in a few moments in the show this morning. Shall we move to South America, Oscar? And finally, it seems that Nicolas Maduro has been confirmed the victor in the election, which I feel like happened a very long time ago now.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is the drama. This is a Greek tragedy in the making. I mean, let's hope it doesn't end as badly as the Oresteid. But here, yes, the Venezuelan electoral body has confirmed that President Maduro won the previous elections in April by less than 1.5 percentage points. Problem is, Mr. Capriles is still refusing to recognize the results, even though he had actually agreed to the terms of the audit. Now he says the audit is fake.
That's it. Is he not trying to? I mean, he's really sort of digging his heels in, electorally speaking, here, isn't he? I mean, I wonder. It has been a long time since that election. What has Capriles been doing in the meantime?
Well, there are two stories here. The government has also, we're going to talk about this, has also unearthed a sort of plot to unseat it from Colombia. So some people are saying that the opposition has been getting at really, you know, shady business here. And that actually the refusal to recognize the election has the potential effect of presenting the government as illegitimate, thereby justifying some sort of coup plot. On the other hand, it is also the case that the Venezuelan Electoral Commission, by recognizing the results, is actually making it absolutely clear that, as the chair of the electoral body put it, the audit shows the results of the election are the faithful reflection of the wishes of our citizens. Still, Mr. Capriles is now running the risk of looking like the sore loser.
And what do you think this sort of says about Maduro's statesmanlike or sort of his leadership, really? I mean, he has handled this period of uncertainty quite well.
That's the case. Actually, I must say I'm surprised, because at first it really looked as if things were getting out of control. But he withstood the tide. He has been, confirmed, and his points have been reaffirmed by the proper democratic bodies. It has to be said that actually the National Electoral Commission is not controlled by government, but by the opposition.
Well, let's talk about, we'll stay on Maduro, and this is the sort of new piece of news around him that you've just alluded to. Nine Colombian paramilitaries arrested in an alleged assassination plot.
This is bad news. In fact, I published a column in a Colombian newspaper yesterday suggesting that the Venezuelan drama is beginning to look very much like the Chilean drama looked like back in 1973. Plot, scarcity, and the possibility of a military coup. And I was alluding to certain sources within Colombia who had let me know that members of the opposition were talking to the Colombian paramilitary. And then this story comes out, the Venezuelan government arrested two groups of members of the Colombian paramilitary crossing the border. Apparently, another one already made it to Caracas, and the government is saying that their aim is to plot the assassination of President Maduro.
So weapons, ammunition and fake uniforms of the Venezuelan army were seized, they say. Do these have the hallmarks of a coup?
At the very least, it has the hallmarks of what the Colombian paramilitary are usually up to. And the names do correspond. The groups which have been pointed at, the leaders. And more recently, the Venezuelan government pointed at Mr. Carmona. He's in exile in Colombia after having led the previous military coup against Chavez, which succeeded temporarily. So, bad news here.
Well, let's move on to what I imagine we would hope would be good news, and that's the restarting of negotiations between FARC and the Colombian government. This is a story that we, of course, return to again and again. What's the latest on the positioning? How have they come back to the table?
In fact, this story is connected to the previous one because it is also becoming apparent that there are people in Colombia who are interested in creating unrest in Venezuela so that they can derail the peace process, the Colombian peace process. Venezuela is the main facilitator, and in fact, this round of conversations began by FARC calling for negotiating parties to make sure that Venezuela's role as facilitator remains. Now the theme of the negotiations is a transition to political civilian life. Very, very thorny issue, particularly since in previous occasions, whenever a armed leftist party made it to civilian political life, the response from the far right has been violent.
And what are we actually seeing in terms of the terms of the negotiation? We've seen FARC really reduce their number of paramilitaries, reduce weapons. What are the real key points that they're debating in Havana?
Well, there was an agreement on agrarian reform, which is, it was probably the most difficult point. After that is done, now it is about establishing rules which will allow the transition of the FARC to an unarmed political force. And this is a complicated issue because it involves at least three things. Number one, the possibility of a constitutional assembly. Number two, either that or a referendum. And number three, guaranteeing that FARC rebels, continue to do politics unimpeded by other violent forces.
Well, Dr. Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck College of Law, many thanks indeed for coming on the show.
Coming up, we're going to be talking to Dr. Jarno Limnell, cyber expert and director of cybersecurity at network security vendor Stonesoft. Very pleased to have him with us. He'll be here after the break.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Faluda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Crew.
Now, the latest bombshell from whistleblower Edward Snowden has sent the NSA spying revelations global. In an interview with the South China Morning Post, the ex-CIA employee has claimed that the US has been hacking China on a large scale for 3 years. He said Washington routinely targets what he called the network backbones of Beijing.
So it's another potential embarrassment for the US, the nation which has often claimed to be on the receiving end of cyber espionage from China. It's also pointed the finger at North Korea and Syria over their cyber politics. So it's all prompted us to take a look now at how cyber warfare is evolving. Is this the weapon that means the giants can be felled by the minnows? And how far away are we from a cyber disaster, an online attack with serious real-world consequences? Well, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by Dr. Jarno Limnell, world-renowned expert on cybersecurity, no less. Welcome to the programme. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So perhaps you could start by assessing for us whereabouts we are in the evolution of cyber warfare. Clearly, an area that is evolving at a rapid pace by the nature of what it is. This isn't just about sort of murky accusations against China anymore, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think the starting point, what we have to understand here is that the cyber is not primarily a technology and technological questions. It's very strategic as the details and the examples that you just gave us shows. What is happening in the Korean Peninsula at this moment, accusations between the United States and China, thinking about this whistleblower news lately and so on. So this is very strategic question nowadays, and it has very strong implication also for the national security policies and international policies. And what we have to understand, especially here in the Europe, is that the United States has already declared that cyber threats are the number one threats against their national security. So this is very hard language.
And when we're talking about cyber attacks and major cyber attacks and cyber warfare even. Are we looking at a possible loss of life? I mean, I wonder if you could spell out what you think the scenario could be in terms of a cyber attack on a large scale.
We have to understand that I usually separate these two worlds. One is the world of the atoms, the physical world, the physical reality which is around us. And the other one is the man-made, artificial cyber domain, the world of the bits. And how dependent we are on the world of the bits nowadays changes actually the logic how we have to understand the security. And when you think about all the functions here in the United Kingdom, in the industries, in the societies, in the armed forces, how they function via cyber, I think we can say that we are very dependent on them. And at the same time, there are lots of different actions and many nation states also who are using and developing very dangerous cyber capabilities in order to produce damage in the physical world, not in the world of the bits, but in the physical world. And that means not primarily the targets are not military ones. They are from the society, they are the critical infrastructure, and that is one the key issue why we are having these discussions nowadays so strongly, that we have to have strong defenses in our critical infrastructure.
All of this talk of defense and nations against other nations, it's all very Cold War language, isn't it? Even though it has, it's dealing with this sort of virtual, not physical sphere. Are we going to see a parallel development of a sort of cyber arms race then between nations?
We are not going to see, because we are already living in the cyber arms race era. And it's actually amazing, I have to say, to see how strongly, especially governments, including United Kingdom, is putting resources to develop different cyber capabilities. And now we have to understand that develop these capabilities does not only mean the defensive ones. They include also capabilities to cyber espionage, which more or less everybody is doing, whatever they are saying in public. And on the other hand, capabilities for the offense, cyber capabilities.
So a cyber deterrent, essentially, is what we're talking about.
That's a very problematic question nowadays, to build cyber deterrence. Because if you possess offensive cyber capabilities, how you show them? How the other ones is to know what you have, because it's something that you can't present, for example, in the military parades. At least I haven't seen any nerd parades so far in the world.
What a thought. I mean, in terms of the nerds and you know, actually recruiting for this type of expertise, who do you think really is, you know, actually ahead in terms of this race to really be, you know, up to speed with defensive and offensive cyber capabilities?
You are absolutely correct. Let me correct a little bit. Yes, I agree that there is a cyber arms race going on, and that's very fierce at this moment in the world. But it's much stronger and bigger competition at this moment in the race to hiring these talented individuals. And more or less everybody is looking for them. Governments, criminal organizations, different hacktivist groups, everybody is want to hire these people, because it's not so much about the muscles in the cyber domains. It's about the knowledge and the know-how what you have.
Well, that's it. I wonder, given that the sort of criteria of strength are slightly different in this world, does it mean that that we are looking at a slightly different playing field? That I talked about minnows being able to take on the giants. Is there a different world map emerging of cyber strength versus old-style physical strength?
Actually, that's my topic of my second doctoral thesis that I am working on at this moment. How strongly cyber will change the logic of the international politics, especially because I think that the superpowers in the physical world, they will not dominate in the same way as they dominate the physical world, the world of the bits. And I think we will see some changes. For example, Israel, pretty small country with more or less 6 million people. And I count them as one of the top 5 cyber actors in the world.
And interestingly, it looks like you can really sort of turn quite quickly. I mean, some of the recruitment here is looking for hackers, or looking to sort of convert people that were on the wrong side very, very quickly and get them sort of working for governments and agencies around the world.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we have to understand also here that the money talks. How much you pay money, you get the good hackers. And this is something that recruiting is ongoing by the terrorist groups, by the governments, by the criminal organizations. Everybody is looking for these talented individuals.
Dr. Jarno Limonell, that's all we've got time for, but really interesting to talk to you. Thanks very much
Thank
for coming
much.
In on this morning's Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Монако 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Dominic Reynolds. This week, the Urbanist team are presenting a roundup of the New Cities Summit in Sao Paulo. They'll be speaking to Ambassador Thomas A. Shannon, the US's man in Brazil, about the challenges Brazilian cities face, and they'll take a tour of downtown Sao Paulo to see how it's changing for the better.
But in this preview, we're going to hear from Lady Barbara Judge. She's the chairman, or chairperson, perhaps I should say, of the UK Pension Protection Fund. But she has an impressive list of other past board positions too. She's also an American who ended up in the UK and has got to know two cities very well, New York and London.
She was at the conference to talk about city strategies for business, but Andrew Tuck got her started on the topic of mayors, including one she admires a lot, Michael Bloomberg.
New York was a dreadful place in the 70s. It was dirty, it was ugly, it was unsafe, and it wasn't viable financially. And it was almost went bankrupt in 1975. And what happened subsequently was that the government, the governors, the government in the city, the mayor, the financial community, the real estate community, and the legal community got together and said, we cannot let this happen to our city. We cannot let business go into the suburbs, into other states. We cannot let the tax base get lower and lower, and we cannot have our people have a lousy education and, in fact, an unsafe environment. And I think it's a coalition, starting with the leadership of the city, starting with the political leadership, getting together the leaders of the financial community, the leaders of the legal community, and the leaders of the real estate community, together with urban planners to have a seriously big vision. I don't think you can do it by pockets. I think you have to have a group of people empowered to put in the right regulations, making investors feel that their money is being used properly, that the corruption is very low, indeed no corruption, transparency, so that they'll feel that their investment is worth it. But you need an overview, and the overview has to come from the leadership, the political leadership particularly.
I think in the past people have been unsure about how big business should get involved in running cities. But what's really interesting, there does seem to be a change. I guess people watch businesses and realize that their good CEOs are often in power for 20 years or 30 years, whereas their mayor may be gone in 4 years. And what's interesting about New York is, I guess, an agenda was started, a conversation that has been carried on by all those mayors because there's such a support network around them that's not going to let that conversation drop. Do you think that people have been a bit too cautious in the past about allowing business, about allowing other interests to have their say in how the city is governed?
Actually, that's a very good question. I do think that big business has a huge role to play. They have money. They have money, and they're part of the tax base. And if we give them the room to help the leadership in terms of providing that financial base, I think we'd be better off. I think there's so much distrust of business and that we aren't really giving it credit. Look at this where we are today. Cisco and GE were on your panel today talking about how to provide a better atmosphere in a city. But it's important that it's not just business alone. It has to be a partnership between business and the government and the people. And I still think that starts with leadership. But you've got to get the government in a pattern so that the mayors can stay for a couple of terms and the next mayors carry on the work. They don't change it or get rid of it.
And can I ask you about that governance issue? You know, that New York has been very lucky to have two or three people who have come along who have had really clear visions, whether you agree or don't agree with their vision, but they had a vision about what to do with New York, most recently Mike Bloomberg. How important do you think it is to have a civic leader who can represent your city but also be a bit of a CEO for your city as well?
I think Mike Bloomberg has done a brilliant job, totally brilliant. And being a CEO for the city is a great way to put it. And you know what? He was a CEO. He was an entrepreneur. He was a CEO. He understood how to make things happen. Started Bloomberg's from nothing, as you know. The people who are running the city have to be real world people. They have to understand how to get things done. thinking about the problems, intellectualizing is a good thing to have around you, but that's not the person that's going to drive forward the change. You need real leaders to drive forward the change. They're dealing with here and now, not 40 years from now.
And you now live in London. That city is also changing quite a lot. Do you feel comforted, or do you feel it's going in the right direction?
I do. I'm interested in London from the point of view of urban planning and housing. Since I've been there, which is 20 years now, there's been a tremendous change in the south side of the river, which has now become home not only to MI6 and to the Covent Garden Flower Market, but to masses and masses of apartment buildings, which were never there before. And I think that we're bringing people back into beautiful homes in which they can live comfortably, because the environment is changing around. I give a lot of credit to the builders. I happen to know Barclay Homes, but the rest of them are doing a good job too. They're being made not only to build luxurious apartments, but to build social housing and to build atmospheres around, to have stores and streets and parks, so that people feel like they're in a community. And that community is stretching far around the city into places where people will want to live, not where they have to live.
And that was Lady Barbara Judge speaking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck for this week's New Cities Summit special edition of The Urbanist. To catch the full programme, tune in tonight at 1900 London time.
I certainly will. Thank you for the recommendation. In the next half hour of the programme, we're going to head to Bamako for the latest news from Mali with art woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. We will also get the latest from the Canadian front pages with David Michon. He'll be here in the studio. Plus, in a few moments, renowned author Wendy Law Yone joins us to reflect on her new book.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Sophie. The Turkish government has ordered protesters to leave Istanbul's central Gezi Park immediately. Plans to redevelop the park led to the protests, which lasted 2 weeks and spread to other Turkish cities. The government says it would consider holding a referendum on the plans for residents of Istanbul. Supporters of the Greek national TV station ERT have held a protest concert at its Athens headquarters the day after the government closed it down without warning. The closure has prompted a 24-hour general strike. Roughly one in three Americans say the former security contractor who leaked details of top-secret US surveillance activity should not be prosecuted. Some 23% of those surveyed in a Reuters-Ipsos poll said Edward Snowden is a traitor, while 31% said he is a patriot. Another 46% said they didn't know. 6 months on from the massacre at Sandy Hook School in Newton, Connecticut, family members of some of the victims have returned to Washington as the Obama administration plans to restart its push for gun control measures. The Australian long-distance swimmer Chloe McArdle has abandoned her attempt to become the first person to swim the 103 miles from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage after being stung by a jellyfish on Wednesday night. Those are the main stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, when Burma gained independence in 1948, after more than a century of British rule, one newspaper arrived on the scene that brought with it a level of scrutiny that kept the political classes in check. It kickstarted what's now regarded as a golden age for Burmese press freedom. That newspaper was The Nation. Edward Law Yone was the man who founded it.
In 1962, the military coup changed The Nation irrevocably. The so-called Burmese Way to Socialism, led by military leaders, began a regime of brutal intolerance across the spectrum. The Nation was closed and Edward Law Yone jailed. He later escaped to America to be reunited with his family, keeping his manuscripts of the time for posterity.
Well, he entrusted his papers to his daughter, the author Wendy Law Yone, who until now had stayed clear of delving into the manuscripts. That was until her latest book, Golden Parasol, A Daughter's Memoir of Burma. I'm happy to say Wendy joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Midori House.
Good morning.
I suppose the first question is, what led you to leave them for 20 years and then uncover them at this point in time?
You know, I think when you are making your way as an immigrant, which we all were in America, we'd come by different routes to the States. It's all of us are struggling in our own ways to sort of eke out a living. And I think my father's story was so big and he'd had so many setbacks that there was just a natural resistance. And plus, you know, he was a larger-than-life character and he overshadowed everything we did. And I was probably trying to just carve out my own identity at the time. I mean, there were many, many reasons. I was also very daunted by just the sheer volume of the manuscript. And I think for a long time I felt sort of ashamed that I had let lie this, you know, this sort of legacy that had been handed me. But when I think now about it, some things just have to settle for a long time. And the fact that I finished the book just about the time when Burma was opening up was just pure coincidence. It's just one of those fateful things that happened.
I mean, the world is very much studying the transition in Burma at the moment, but your book is very intriguing in that it takes us back to a time when, you know, it was a very different place. And I wondered, could you give us an insight into the memoirs of your father and the world that he lived in?
He wrote two memoirs, and it was quite ingenious in a way. His first memoir was much tighter and... Well, he also had more time for reflection because they were written in jail. He was in jail for 2 years in solitary and then another 3 years. And at some point, I think he managed to bribe the jailers into getting him these little exercise books. I still have them. They're very, very poignant because they're the kind of exercise books that, you know, school children use. And he wrote in them... the story of his life till jail. Necessarily, it had to stop at the time he was jailed because of, in case the censors discovered it. But afterwards, after he had had a second career as a revolutionary and had gone to America to live out the rest of his life in exile, he put down the rest of his story in this huge manuscript. And that detailed everything that had happened to him during the coup and after the coup. And it's a very racy, it had this kind of, it was very alive and it had both gossip and history and analysis, but it would have taken a monumental task to edit and annotate it because he doesn't explain. You can see that he's racing against time. So there are all these names and these dates and these events, and sometimes you don't know he's talking about the same event. So my instinct, original instinct, that this manuscript was sort of untackleable,
yeah,
were I think borne out. And when I looked at them again, I thought, what I must do, I still can't really edit them. I'm going to write my version of his version. But it was the reason that I think it is so, it's so important, his document, is that there's a kind of pocket of forgetfulness in that period. Because when the military regime took over, there was a complete sort of a blackout and nobody was writing anymore. Universities were closed, scholars couldn't publish. And people think that that there was really nothing between the post-war government and the military regime.
And so you're shining a light on a period which hasn't had a lot of light shone on it.
I hope so.
As you flick through the book, there are pictures which jump out at you, and a lot of family photos, which clearly you've brought out of your own archives, and it made me think that, you know, we often talk about the journey of a country like Burma in terms of leadership changes and economic changes, but this is the change that we all experience. It's about people and it's about families, isn't it? And I presume you must have discovered lots of things about your father and your family that you just hadn't known before.
Yes, I think it was, I think, particularly striking for my siblings because when you are writing the book, the discoveries happen as you go along. But they who, for whom family history had been sort of consigned to oblivion, big parts of it, I think found it quite startling in many ways. But I remember just being struck by one thing. The interesting thing is that the lack of, it's not as surprising as one would think. And I think that was a function of my father's, he had a capacity for, I don't want to say exhibitionism, but he let everything out and he had no secrets. That was his great weapon. He kept his enemies close to him and he had no secrets. So if you have no secrets, you know, everything can be known and nothing can be hurled against you. So in a way, I had, you know, no huge surprises, but they were just small little discoveries here and there that I thought were revealing about himself in ways that he wouldn't have known.
And what type of journalist was he? Because we're talking really about a golden era of reporting and publishing in Burma, not something that's discussed very often. Can you give us an insight into the paper that he ran?
He had, you know, when I discovered his newspapers at the newspaper library archive, and this was a huge, huge revelation for me because I hadn't seen the newspapers since we left Burma. And so it was like finding this family relic that I thought was forever lost and in Colindale of all places. And so I was mesmerized and I was looking, as I sat there, you know, just going through all of the archives, it struck me that this newspaper was something more than just a paper. He was clearly more than just a journalist. I mean, it's difficult to characterize his role. He was a kingmaker. He was into everything. He knew everybody. He, he was advising the prime minister. He was on the board of censors, on rice commissions, and a self-appointed economic emissary. He would go to, America on a fellowship, and somehow, the next thing people knew, he was sort of trying, lobbying for American aid. So the newspaper had very much the stamp of his voice on it. His articles were biting, opinionated. But the one thing that I discovered was that it seemed to me he was constructing a whole narrative for a country. It wasn't just a newspaper. He had sort of a moral mission, to tell people how a country should be run.
Well, I wonder, given that narrative that you speak of there, you've got a fairly unique perspective, I should say. Well, you can't be fairly unique. You have a unique perspective on the history of the last sort of 50 plus years. That being the case, having gone through all of this stuff, how do you look at contemporary Burma now?
Well, I keep thinking about what my father would make of these changes now. In a way, there was a sort of disloyal thought I had at the time. Because things were so sad back when he died and so grim, I thought when he died later on, one of the secret thoughts I had was, well, it's probably just as well, because he can't do anymore. And I've often thought, what would he make of what was going on now? I think his curiosity would have been very robust still. So he would have been quite, amused by much of what Burma has inherited now. But it is such a different world. I mean, the stakes are larger, the players are different. Burma's whole geostrategic position has changed. I think he would have been very disdainful of the level of education and, let's say, patriotism of the current leadership.
Wendy, it's such an interesting perspective. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Wendy Law-Yone is author of the new book, Golden Parasol, A Daughter's Memoir of Burma. A very interesting read it is too. Thanks very much for coming in.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our woman in Bamako, Mali.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing, every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:46 in London and 7:46 in Bamako, Mali, which is where we head now to look at the headlines with our woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks.
Let's talk Mandela first, even though you are in Bamako, Mali. All eyes are really on Mandela's condition.
Indeed, and I don't know if you've had a chance for an update in the news, but what I was checking on this morning, apparently President Zuma has made a speech to Parliament saying that he's now responding better to treatment after his fifth day in hospital, 94 years old, of course, and we expect the worst to be imminent fairly soon. But it's quite interesting to sort of chat to people about Mandela here in West Africa, because of course globally Mandela's an icon. In South and Southern Africa he's an icon, and here there's a much more curious relationship with him, because he was in prison for so long, and people didn't hear of him for so long. When he came out there was all that excitement. So you have a generation gap. You have people who went to school and wrote letters to the South African government demanding Mandela's release, and then you have all the younger people who actually don't have a very strong relationship with Mandela, probably most likely because the media didn't have the same sort of impact here as it's had in the rest of the world, and obviously in Southern Africa. So he's not on everyone's lips here in the same way, and there's a certain generation talking about, asking me questions about Mandela's health, because of course African students I know, because I used to live in South Africa.
Well, big changes closer to your home at the moment coming up, because Mali's got presidential elections towards the end of next month. Parts of the country, though, still under rebel control. Talks apparently have begun. How have those talks gone so far?
Yes, in a nutshell, essentially there are parts of northern Mali which the MNLA, which is a liberation movement, a secessionist group, so not an Islamist group, but a secessionist group, has continued occupying, and one of them in particular is the town of Kidal, which is one of the main urban centres in the north. The MNLA won't let in the Malian army or the Malian authorities, which of course creates a problem if you want to hold national presidential elections, which is the plan on the 28th of July. Well, France, which is sort of in the background, says that's no problem and we're going to sort out a deal. The deal was expected to be ready on Monday. It hasn't. The deal was being negotiated in neighbouring Burkina Faso, and negotiations seem to be at a low point, because yesterday the entire negotiating team came to Bamako, and where they're now here talking behind closed doors. So I can't tell you how well it's going, but there are indications that it's not going very well. And of course, you know, the international community is pressing hard for these elections on the 28th of July as a marker in Mali's way out of the crisis. And if they can't go ahead, it's a real setback for the move towards peace.
Alex, I wanted to touch on another issue, galactic in its scope. The Nigerian space program, very, very intriguing. Can you tell us any more?
Well, I heard you slightly smile or laugh.
I think it might have been a laugh.
But, chuckle, I would
just
say.
Very intriguing. It's been talked about for quite a while, but I'd be interested to know if you had any insights there.
Well, let me try and tell you what we know, which is that Nigeria, what it lacks in sort of scientific advances, it does actually have in spades when it comes to entrepreneurial spirit. We agree. And Nigeria does have a space program, has had since 2001. In fact, they're the only African country that owns and operates their own spacecraft, having four satellites in orbit. You didn't know that, did you?
I didn't.
And one of them, the Nigeria Sat-10 was even built by Nigerian engineers, not in Nigeria, but by Nigerian engineers. So, you know, we're getting somewhere. And President Goodluck Jonathan has seized on this and very much made it his mission to put Nigeria on the map as a space country. And essentially, he's just made a speech to the National Space Council. He hasn't announced more satellites into orbit, but he's sort of said, look, you know, we've done this well. Let's build on it, and let's use this to prove to ourselves that we can have an industry, that we can build up our economy. We can build cars, we can build trains, we can build boats, we can build aircraft, and we can even land our own satellites manufactured in Nigeria. So it's all about sort of a big ego boost, you know, an ego boost speech, not new announcements concretely, but what Nigeria can do and needs to start believing that it can do.
Alex, I want to bring it down to earth very briefly, if we can, and from sort of the galactic scale to your postman. What's the story of your postman?
Oh, I just have to tell you about Dumbi Abubakar. He's my postman. And since I've been in Mali for 3 months, I assumed, as one does in countries which have got sort of nil governance and dysfunctional in so many ways, so that there wouldn't be a postal service. And so I've told everyone this because some people will send you letters. And I've discovered that I have a postman. And I met him yesterday, and he drives a yellow scooter, which was donated by the French Post Office. He wears a blue uniform and a blue cap with a yellow band on it, also donated by the French Post Office. Wears a tie, has different coloured pens in his top left pocket, and delivers the post. And so he arrived yesterday, no, day before yesterday with a letter. And yesterday he rang me to say, I've got another letter for you from London. I'm coming over. How many people can claim to have their own personal postman in West Africa?
You are an extremely fortunate lady, Alex Duval-Smith. Thank you very much, as ever, for joining us on Midori House. Alex Duval-Smith is our woman in Bamako, Mali. And we will have a bit of music now, live, in fact, from a Midori House session. Here's Tegan and Sarah. That is the sound of David Michon at the end of Tegan and Sarah. David Michon is here to run through some Canadian papers with us this morning. How are you?
Hello, sorry, I was just chatting.
Super eager.
Chatting away.
Okay, well, the light is on. What are we talking about?
Canadian papers are always ridiculous, I have to say. I'm never really
that's
that
an opening gambit if I've ever heard one.
If it's not, you know, some incredibly massive spread about hockey, it's the cover of the National, you know, it's the front page of the National Post, which is about, you know, the lead story is about a teen that was being bullied in the United States for being Canadian.
Right.
This is a lead story on a national paper. So he lives in some town that's 40 kilometers south of the border, and I guess his teacher is also the principal, referring to Canada as a place that was cartoonishly small, where people just liked to club seals for fun.
It's pretty bad. The headline is Tormented New York Teen's Sin. He was born in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't really be more dramatic. Is this a familiar, for people familiar with Canadian papers, is this a line of story which will be, you know, something they encounter a lot, stop bullying us, please?
Canadians do just love gobbling up these types of stories about, you know, the ways that Americans kind of abuse us or disregard us as a nation. So anything that's involved with this, I'm not terribly surprised it's made front page news, but I wish that we kind of had some other, there's a lot of other important issues happening in Canada.
I mean, I'm sure clearly, we don't want to belittle his torment. I'm sure it was yes, torment indeed.
He's now being homeschooled. He has left the public school system.
It's only going to get worse if you do homeschooling, my opinion. But there we go. Cloven Vale.
Maybe they should just move back to Canada if they're that proud nationally. So there's, it's been kind of a rough time for Canadian Southerners at the moment. Several of them are being audited. So this is on the front page of the Globe and Mail and the National Post. So Pamela Wallen, who was a very famous Canadian broadcaster, is now a senator. And she is being, she's had to step down from the board of directors of Porter Airlines and had previously stepped down from the wealth management firm, Gluskin Sheff and Associates, for questions over her expenses. And there's a second senator who's been forced to pay back, or who is going to be forced to pay back $231,000 plus in expenses. So this is...
I wonder, is that the expenses, sort of journalistic scoops about expenses have not just happened in Canada, of course, over the last few years. And I wonder the correlation between enormous journalistic scoops about expenses and newspapers having a difficult time with circulations. Do you know what I mean there?
It doesn't really seem to stop politicians from abusing their expense accounts, of course.
It certainly doesn't. I'm glad we're catching them out.
If it's not, yes. Well, it doesn't seem like it's a trend that will end at... anytime soon, certainly. There's also a story from the Globe and Mail about Quebec putting forward a new bill about euthanasia, the right to die. And of course, this is a province that has previously pushed legislation on same-sex marriage and gay marriage as well. So this is kind of their new battleground, of course.
And it should be said the Globe and Mail also has an exclusive interview with the Turkish president, Abdullah Gül, looking at his view of the protests and saying that if Syria dealt with their protests like Turkey did, then they wouldn't have had a civil war.
Sophie, thank you very much. David Michon, our managing editor, thank you very much. That is all the time we have for today's show. It was produced by Alid John. The researchers were James Bullock and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Chris Fitch was the studio manager. Rob Bounds up next with the latest episode of Culture, and then Tom Edwards will be here with the briefing at midday London time. But from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And me, Sophie Grove.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.